This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 11th of May 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to episode 253 of the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, has America been fighting the wrong enemy in Afghanistan? We'll speak to the New York Times' Carlotta Gould, whose new book reveals Pakistan's deep involvement with the Taliban.
Plus, we'll meet author Simon Goddard, who's chronicled the history of Postcard Records, a label that kickstarted the 1980s indie revolution in the UK by mistake.
Speaking of music, albeit in a slightly different genre,
let's talk about love.
We'll take a trip to what Canadian critic Carl Wilson calls the end of taste, and we'll ask him why some people love Celine Dion so much.
All that plus some non-Celine type of music right here on the Monocle Weekly. Hi, Andrew.
Hello.
It's been a while since we've done this show together.
I know, you've been wandering.
I've been gallivanting. Presumably in the top of the show there for that clip that we played in from Celine Dion, there's presumably a CD missing from your collection in order to play that into the show today.
Well, I nearly fainted having to say those words, the end of taste. What are they on about?
The end of taste, beginning of it more like.
Have they been in my house? Don't they know?
Many romantic moments for Andrew Tuck, you know, has been soundtracked.
She represented Switzerland in the Eurovision Song Contest once.
I didn't know this until I overheard you telling someone about it. Putting someone right about it in the office this week.
There's a very weird divide on our floor, and I'm on certainly one side of that divide, that people are either talking about the World Cup or Eurovision.
I like to sit in both those camps. Yeah. I've got a comfy stool in both those camps. So last night was the big night.
Yes, it was a big
night. For those people that are on different time zones, let's not right. Plot spoil that one.
Well, because I was just about to tell you what I thought. But anyway, we shall save that thought.
I'm kind of looking forward to today's show, a story of kind of good taste and bad. Postcard Records, the Glasgow label that sort of were the touchstone for so many of the coolest bands in the world of the 1980s, 1990s, and now. And then a man that's written about your beloved Celine and described it as the end of taste.
And a bit of Afghan war
in the middle.
And they've
got some Afghan war in the middle. I don't know whether that's the yeast in the loaf.
Okay.
They tend to favour the flatbreads in that part of the world, don't
okay.
they?
Okay. That's another story,
all right. I can say that.
Okay. Yeah. Shall we have Tom Edwards in before we get
Tom
in trouble?
Let's get a man who actually knows what he's talking about. It's Tom Edwards.
Baby. Who knew the news could be so hot? Delivering a look ahead to the week's events, here's Tom Edwards.
Wow. And who did that voiceover? Did you do your own voiceover, Tom?
No, well, I would try, but I don't have such a beautiful tone as that.
I think it's Joshua Fennett, isn't it?
I think it might be our good friend Matt Allagaia.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Wow.
Is it?
It's full of surprises.
Okay. Welcome to the show, Tom.
Hi, Rob. Hi, Andrew.
Your glasses fell off when you heard that.
I know. Well, I think I was trying to get the steam off them. It's quite...
I'm
carrying a bit of sporting injury from last weekend, so I'm just stretching out.
What happened last weekend?
Bit of a hamstring injury, Rob.
Football?
Yeah.
Five-a-side
indeed.
And did you fall over?
It rapidly became... I didn't actually fall over, no. I scored a goal.
Yeah.
And in doing that for the team, made it into a four-a-side game.
You took one, really?
Unfortunately, yeah.
Oh dear.
Just stretching out now.
Did you overextend your leg or something?
I don't know. It's a sudden burst of pace. That's what it does. Explosive athletic endeavour.
Yeah.
You just felt to leave that
one.
For our listeners, we should let people know that Tom has his legs in the air. But that's...
He's got just one up on a little stool.
Okay, let's start news the news time. Look ahead.
Let's start. Now, you know, I like to talk about auctions and the arts.
We've got
quite a few sort of fairly frothy stories for you this week.
Oh,
I'm
good.
Feeling pretty light and limber.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to see, you know, some of the seminal works that are coming up for sale. Potential record breakers this week, Christie's in New York. You've got Warhol's White Marilyn, 1962, one of the, you know, most famous even of his well-known portraits. $12 to $18 million, probably in the sort of Andrew Tuck budget, I would imagine.
Mm.
I think that's quite cheap, isn't it, for a Warhol?
For you it is, yeah.
don't make us all feel bad.
It is a silk screen. I'm sure you could run another one off.
Yes, there's probably a few of them knocking around. Jackson Pollock's Number 5, brackets Elegant Lady. 1951.
That's a Laura's. How much does that? Squint to see the Elegant Lady in that.
That
picture.
Could be $15 to $20 million. But what's interesting about that, I think, is that Eon, the big sort of energy company, they're selling it, and they have an amazing art collection, and they're selling it to raise money for several things that they do. One is that they support the Kunstpalast Museum in Düsseldorf, and then they also reinvest the money they make from selling off previous works into new acquisitions. So I like to see that kind of corporate responsibility directed into the arts.
Me too. Yeah. It's interesting timing for the auctions, which always happen at the same time of year. Mm. But that Frieze Fair, which has been on this week or last week, has really sort of snuck in there to try and basically get everyone's money out of them before the auctions, which is quite clever.
I always find it interesting that there is a sort of auction season, because you kind of think you might get better results if you staggered it a little more, but obviously they just like to capitalise on everyone being there.
Yeah. No, it's a bit of a feeding
frenzy. Huge
frenzy,
it is. It is certainly frenzy, and there's all sorts of other notable works coming up for sale over the next kind of.
Are these Christie's or Sotheby's?
These are
mostly Christie's.
This is Christie's, those couple, but yeah, Sotheby's, there's all the big names.
And Padel 8, our mate Adam
Mr. Gilkes.
Mr. Gilkes.
Alexander Gilkes.
Alexander Gilkes, who runs Padel 8. They're doing well, and they're doing some quite interesting things this week. They've got this Grace Coddington thing on, haven't they? This nudes thing, which is quite good, which I think is happening at the same time.
It's a celebration of the arts and of the auction.
The nudes, it's a celebration
business.
Of the arts. Come on, let's have some more news.
Well, let's move on. More arts news, different genre. Cannes Film Festival, the 66th edition. Easy for me to say. Obviously taking place, lots of big important features, new works from, you know, a huge range of auteurs, the more modest filmmakers, as I like to call them, but all sorts of things, you know, really interesting. I always think to chart both, you know, what's recognised, what are the trends, and there's usually some good sort of movie business intrigue that
there's
comes
always,
to light.
There's always, yeah, there's always some nice pictures of some nice looking people getting off boats, and I think that's really the way to arrive. You can go to Toronto, it's quite nice, and this and that and all the rest of it. Sundance, all right, you're getting out of 4x4. Cannes is good.
To the Cannes Film Festival?
Yeah.
Did you arrive in a speedboat?
No, but what's quite funny is
a little black number.
So what happens is, for the films, that, you know, all these kind of, you know, starlets arrive in their kind of frocks, and it's a bit kind of like overdone. Mm. But what happens is lots of them walk into the film, then they leave. Because that's all they need. They just need to have that picture taken in. So there's a whole kind of like, you know, all these people outside. And then you kind of see them coming in, but they don't all go and sit down. Lots
strange,
of them just then go
that's
home.
A triumph of superficiality,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
But hopefully there'll be a bit more robust.
Well, it's too nice for going to the cinema,
critically,
anyway.
I suppose that's true.
In a big frock.
But you've got Jane Campion, who won the Carol Storr Honorary Award last year, is presiding over the main jury. And there's all sorts. You've got Sofia Coppola, Willem Dafoe, Lila Hatami, Gael Garcia Bernal, they're all joining as well. So lots of interesting.
And Lars von Trier has been banned this year. Not this year, but from henceforth onwards, I think. From last year
he's
onwards.
He's kind of banned himself as well, though, hasn't he?
Has he sort of banned himself?
I think he said he's not going to say any more words because after he said.
It's difficult, isn't it? I don't know where I stand on that.
Well, yeah, he's probably. It's, watch the films, I'd say.
Yeah, exactly.
So don't say any more words, Lars. We'll just watch the films.
Yeah, pipe down over there.
Yeah.
I've got a couple more very brief ones. Sort of cultural happening of its own, the Grand Sumo Tournament in Tokyo, Japan this week. There are several. There's 6 Grand Sumo events each year. This one is being held at Ryogoku in Tokyo. And so all the ranks of sumo wrestlers engage in all these different bouts. 2 weeks to see who will be the Yokozuna, the Grand Champion.
I'd like to see that.
I think it's
we did a brilliant expo, actually, in the magazine, which
it's gone through a very tough time, so it's been increasingly difficult to find people who were willing to go through the rigours of the camp, because it's very, very structured.
Mongolia, that's where they get them.
Yeah, a huge number now from that side.
I like sumo, and I think it's beautiful. I think there's it's got that sort of ancient grandeur to it and all the rest of it. I wouldn't mind seeing it fuse with other sports to make it more relevant to the 21st century. What do you think about that? What do you think about sumo being merged with snooker?
Or badminton.
I'd love to see that.
Or downhill skiing. Or beach volleyball.
Just set them off rolling down the slopes. I think snooker would be particularly.
Snooker would be really weird, wouldn't
yeah,
it?
That would be incredible. Snookerzuna.
Snookerzuna.
Snooko.
Yeah.
Snook. Anyway, let's do that later at the end of the show. Think of someone. We'll scribble them down.
And just finally, I just mentioned one last one. Were you talking about bread earlier? Did I misunderstand? I think so. When you're having your culinary discussion at the top of the show.
Flatbread.
It's appropriate in what a manner of speaking, because this is, again, it's a bit parochial, but I rather like the sound of it. It's British Sandwich Week.
Ooh.
That starts today. 11.5 billion sandwiches are consumed just in the UK every year. I mean, this is a staple.
Yeah.
So why do you need to have a special week for them?
Well, because you've got to give thanks to the 330,000 people employed in this country in the sandwich profession.
No.
330,000. There's also the British Sandwich Industry Awards Dinner. I'm not making this up. British Sandwich Designer of the Year Award.
Oh, my God.
It's presented on the 15th. The real art, the sandwich artists are recognised.
I love a sandwich. Something kind of rather honest, I think, in our era of sort of sushi and wraps and things like this. Salads for lunch. No, thanks.
Do you think you could enter a BAP in that, or is it just strictly sliced?
I've got to be honest, I don't know. I haven't read the full rubric.
A filled roll.
I think it has to be a proper sandwich with sliced bread.
I could enter the BAP category. I've got some ideas.
Have you got a bet on? You said it three times.
I just think it's a very funny word, BAP. Would you like a BAP?
I'd like to.
BAP.
That's probably some kind of world record. But let's champion. Let's celebrate the sandwich pioneers.
Yeah.
You know, this is one of the many culinary masterpieces that Britain gave to the world.
Let's go around the... I quite like a bridge roll. Actually, it's got more brioche sweet.
Let's
go around the table. My favourite sandwich is... I'm an egg mayo man.
Oh,
Andrew.
Smoked salmon.
Both pretty good. I like to get...
The clock's ticking.
I like to get variety meats.
Chicken tikka masala.
Variety.
Old traditionist.
I like to get variety meats in there.
Variety of meats?
Variety meats. So you've got to have at least two different kinds of meats.
No, I don't want that. I like a club sandwich.
Well, that's got two kinds of meats in it.
Yeah, I'm just saying, on that tip, that's
I feel like you criticised my sandwich choice and then endorsed the same sandwich.
Yeah, I didn't really think it through. I'm sorry.
Well, now we've fallen out. Over this.
What a way to end. Let's give him a soundtrack and pat him on the behind. Tom Edwards, thank you.
Pat him on the bap.
Tom, thank you very much for your music aid.
Oh, it's a pleasure as always.
We may be fighting the wrong enemy in the wrong country. That's what the late Richard C. Holbrooke, United States Special Representative to Afghanistan and Pakistan, had to say about the Afghanistan war. What he meant was America's real opponent, and the hand that fed the Taliban was Pakistan and its powerful intelligence agency, the ISI, and its army.
Now the US is retrieving its troops after the deaths of perhaps 70,000 Afghans and some 3,400 foreign soldiers after a war that cost America $1 trillion, Carlotta Gall, former Afghanistan bureau chief of the New York Times, comes to the same conclusion as Holbrooke in her book The Wrong Enemy. Gall is well placed to judge. She spent 10 years in the region and was even assaulted by the ISI back in 2006 while reporting on the Pakistan-Afghanistan border. She's on the line with us now from Tunis, where she's currently based. Carlotta, welcome to the programme. And first of all, obviously your book is a narrative. Is it a narrative because there really isn't one already in our heads of Pakistan's involvement in Afghanistan and what this really means?
Well, I think I wanted to do two things. I also wanted to tell the narrative of the American war in Afghanistan. I was there from the beginning to the end, almost, and so I wanted to tell that arc for anyone. I was particularly thinking of people who were only kids at the time of 9/11 and who would now be maybe students and want to read, well, what was the whole war about? But of course, what happened when I wrote the whole war is it really placed in clearly for me the curve of my understanding of exactly how deeply involved the ISI, the Pakistani intelligence, was in aiding and abetting the Taliban and in fact orchestrating the whole campaign to undermine the Afghan mission of the US and NATO.
And could you explain for our listeners who don't know the story as intricately as you do, you know, what was Pakistan trying to achieve by lending its support to the Taliban?
I think they've always supported the Taliban, and I show this even from the beginning of the Taliban in the 1990s. They've always supported them as a proxy force, one that would be favorable to Pakistan. So, in fact, they've always done this in the history, you know, since the beginning of Pakistan. They've supported groups in Afghanistan that would be favorable to them, almost like a client state or a proxy force. So the Taliban were there very favored proxy force in Afghanistan in the 90s. And so when 9/11 happened and the Taliban was overthrown, Pakistan was suddenly without a friend in Afghanistan. And so very soon after the fall of the Taliban, they started regrouping the Taliban, partly to control them, but then quietly to push them back to go and fight Americans. And the aim was really to tell NATO and American forces, we don't want you, this is our backyard, you should go home. And so the insurgency grew and grew because the American forces grew and grew. And so it became nastier and nastier. But the aim was always of Pakistan to give the message, the foreigners should go home, this is really our domain and we want to dominate it. And that's still their plan, I believe. They're still intending to use the Taliban to undermine the Afghan government and therefore control it to be favorable to them.
I mean, Carlotta, we're talking about Pakistan here, and the title of your book uses it, and certainly the way that it's been serialized in the New York Times and elsewhere just uses the name of the country, Pakistan. Is it that, or is it Pakistan's intelligence agency? How top-down is this policy, if it is such a thing, toward Afghanistan and towards America's foreign policy there?
Right. Well, if you know anything about Pakistan, you know that although they have a civilian government, the military really runs the show, and it has for most of the 60-odd years of Pakistan's history, that they've had a military government more often than not. And they also, even though they have a civilian government, the military controls everything. And so when we talk of the intelligence agency, ISI, that's also a military organization. It's run by military generals. And so it's really a military policy to support the Taliban. I showed that even they protected bin Laden and allowed him to stay in Pakistan. They gave him safe haven, basically. All in the aim of, you know, for their future own hegemony in the region, for their own ideas of combating India, which they see as their great rival. And so it's just been a military policy, and I believe it will only change when the civilian governments get enough strength to seize back security and foreign policy from the military. Because at the moment, everything's decided in the military headquarters.
But Carlotta, it seems a bit of a failed policy in the sense that, you know, for Pakistanis living at home in their own country, it hasn't exactly been safe for them either. You know, the war has spilled over into Pakistan. And Pakistan, oddly, if it did want to kind of shake the Americans and the allies, in the end, it became dependent on outside cash from America itself.
Absolutely. I mean, it's used that very cleverly. So it's been a friend at the face to be a friend of America. So it's milked it for all this money, and it's received huge sums over the years. I mean, $26 billion for most of the 10 years that I was there, in mostly military aid. But at the same time, you're right, they did lose control of their own proxy forces, their militant groups. And some of those have become very vengeful and angry, partly because they feel they've been messed around and used by their own intelligence service. But I think Pakistan, what's amazing is that despite, you know, this comeback that they've had, this backlash of militancy in their own country, destroying their own cities and killing their own people, they still pursue with this agenda, really, because they're still obsessed with dominating Afghanistan and keeping India at bay. And the militant groups, or you might call them non-state actors, have always been central to that military policy, that it's their force enablers, if you wish, for a military term, to increase Pakistan's military stance against a much bigger rival, India. So it's a hiding to nothing. I mean, it's a really ruinous campaign. But what's amazing is that they don't see it and they can't stop. And that's why I think the military are incapable of stopping. They're still pursuing a 30-year plan that they've always had and they still believe in. And that's where new civilian leaders have to just draw a line if they can.
Carlotta, we've mentioned India a couple of times in your last couple of answers. What's India's policy been? Has it been more about investment than in arming the Taliban?
India is problematic to the whole problem, and the main problem is at the base of all this is the dispute between India and Pakistan over Kashmir, which is, as you know, a disputed territory and a long source of aggravation between the two. But India has been sometimes sensible in that they've given quite a lot of humanitarian aid and civilian aid to Afghanistan in the last 10 years, and they've held back on military aid, which I think has been under American pressure. In other words, don't do anything to really rile Pakistan. But there's fears that that will change now, and there's some indications that India might step in and start to help the Afghan military army and with arms and weapons and training. And that, of course, will aggravate the regional problem even more. So it's part of the crux of the matter, and India hasn't been entirely open to Pakistan, but I think it takes two to tango, and both sides have failed to come to peace over Kashmir, and that's the real problem.
And Carlotta, just give us a bit of an indication of what it was like for you reporting there on the ground. We indicated there in the introduction to this piece that you were assaulted in 2006 by the ISI. How tough was it trying to report at that time?
It became very difficult because people were intimidated from helping you. People are intimidated from speaking out about this problem. And local journalists are often arrested or detained or told not to work with foreigners like me. Some of them have even been killed. There's quite a high rate of deaths of Pakistani journalists. And I would say in Afghanistan, it's also incredibly dangerous. You know, it's very difficult to drive anywhere south of Kabul because of the Taliban presence and because they kidnap or kill foreign journalists. So it became extremely difficult. But I think that's what really drives any journalist more, in that this is a horrendous situation for both the people of both countries. And I really wanted to expose that the source of the problem, we have to be cleverer of how to combat this, and we have to look at where the source is coming, and the source of all the radicalism is actually coming from Pakistan. It's not in Afghanistan. And that was the tragedy, that all the fighting was in the Afghan villages. When really we should have gone to the source, to the money, to the ideology that was driving it all.
And finally, let's go back to that. It's the sort of deliciously dangerous title of your book, Carlotta, Holbrooke's The Wrong Enemy. What would have happened if we'd fought, or the United States had fought, the right enemy?
Well, I would never suggest to go and fight Pakistan. It's a huge country. It's got nuclear weapons. It's got 180 million Pakistanis, and a very large army. So I would never suggest that. But I think Admiral Mullen, when he at one point just before retiring in America before Congress, he said that what Pakistan was doing was breaking international law and probably merited sanction. And so there are smart sanctions you could do. That they're basically doing what Russia is doing in Ukraine right now, or Syria is doing to its own people. So it's that sort of action. So there are many things I think we could have done better, cleverer seeking out of Al-Qaeda, control of the amount of money being given to Pakistan and conditional aid, conditionality of aid, which means you only get this money if you behave this way. And I think smart sanctions against Pakistan's generals. There's lots of things that could be done better to force a better policy, because Pakistan is exporting terrorism. I mean, they're radicalizing hundreds of people in their camps still today, and that's incredibly dangerous for not just Afghanistan, for far further afield.
Well, Carlotta Gool, author of The Wrong Enemy, America in Afghanistan, 2001 to 2014, which is out now. Thank you very much for joining us on the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you.
It's time for some music now, and since we're going to look back at the history of one record company that changed the music landscape in the UK and beyond, that's Postcard Records. Up next, we'll play a track from one of their seminal bands. This is Orange Juice with Rip It Up.
Start again. I said, rip it up.
That was Orange Juice with Rip It Up. Up next, we find out how a couple of penniless Scotsmen managed to launch the careers of that band Orange Juice and many others in the 1980s.
The Monocle subscription package is your year-round entry into the world of Monocle. For £90, you get a year of Monocle in print, and that's 10 magazines, including two double issues and our two seasonal newspapers, Alpino and Mediterraneo. You'll get access to online archives and an exclusive tote bag designed by our in-house team and made by our friends at Rutote of Japan. Plus, free shipping to wherever you are in the world. And that's all for £90 sterling. Or you can double your fun with our two-year package for £170, which comes with two bags and our exclusive organiser. So treat yourself, or even a loved one, to a Monocle subscription, available at monocle.com.
You're listening to The Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck. Now, they launched the careers of bands like Orange Juice, Aztec Camera, and post-punk heroes Joseph K. Yet the founders of the Postcard Records label only had a few hundred quid and one band missing a drummer when they decided to start a record company in Glasgow.
Journalist Simon Goddard has chronicled this unlikely success story in his new book, Simply Thrilled, The Preposterous Story of Postcard Records. And he joins us in the studio now to tell us more about the tale. You present it, actually, I think, as a fairy tale. You say that when you went to see all these people, they couldn't quite remember exactly what happened. And they contradicted each other a little bit.
Yeah.
But before we begin, just tell us, or tell listeners, who the cast of characters are, the heroes of your book.
The main heroes of the book are a dropout zoology student in Glasgow called Alan Horn, who grew up in a small town outside Glasgow called Saltcoats on the coast. And his life really wasn't going anywhere until he met this very eccentric young songwriter called Edmund Collins, who used to walk about the streets of Glasgow with a kitten in his pocket.
And, an endless supply.
I think it was always the one. It was always Macintosh the kitten. And he found like his sort of soulmate then, like his kindred spirit, and he realised that Edwin was a brilliant young songwriter, but who needed encouragement to kind of get his band started. And Alan was the person to do that. And the pair of them, starting off with Edwin with his band Orange Juice, Alan like managing them, looking after them. And then they got to a point when they thought, let's start this record label and put a record out and see what happens. I mean, very kind of like naive kind of ambitions. And it is said, I mean, it says on the back of the book that they ran their label from a sock drawer, which was sort of true in as much as, I mean, they had no base. All they had was, like, you know, the wardrobe and the rented flat, and that's where Alan Horn kept his paperwork. But they just had this very kind of, like, DIY approach about it. Right, let's make a record. Let's get it in shops. How do we get it in shops? We'll stick it in the back of a car and we'll drive around. You know, we want John Peel to play it. How do we get John Peel to play it? Well, we'll just hang around outside the BBC until he comes along. And when he comes along, we won't be nice to him. We'll say, listen, you silly old man, you must play our record. So they were very kind of they were fearless, very courageous. And that was kind of like, that was the spirit of Postcard Records. And I thought that's the reason I really wanted to write it, because I thought it was always kind of like romantic, kind of like story of like two outsiders, like against the world and kind of like, you know, winning them over.
And after Edwin Collins, you know, co-founded the label and came out with Orange Juice, and they signed Aztec Camera, they signed Joseph K, as we said.
Yeah,
technically didn't. And the go-betweens and these wonderful bands.
Technically didn't sign anyone. I don't think.
They didn't sign anyone.
Well, I don't think the paperwork in the sock drawer actually had any signatures on it. But yeah, in theory.
And this, obviously these are now legendary bands and bands that have informed a whole sort of genre of music, and so many bands still name check for their inspiration today, maybe especially. Was there a sound? Was there, do you think, a deliberate sound for that Alan and Edwin kind of came up with, or was it people they kicked around with?
I think the sound was purely what was in Edwin and Alan's record collections, and their record collections at that time were pretty much thrift store, junk shop, secondhand. There was a place in Glasgow, no longer there now, called Paddy's Market. Anyone who went there will certainly remember it. It was like a real kind of, I mean, flea market. I mean, I don't know what's smaller and more contagious than the flea, but it was that kind of market. It was stuff on the ground, really, really cheap. But they just go there and they buy like classic, like Motown and stuff from the 60s, pop that they grew up with kids, and Velvet Underground records. And they kind of educated themselves in the music they liked. Plus, they liked a lot of contemporary stuff like disco that was going on. And they just kind of like wanted to kind of like bring the two together. And I think that the sound of Orange Juice really What they were trying to do at the time, whether they knew it or not, or whether the audiences knew it or not, was kind of like bring together kind of like that disco thing that Chic had with the Velvet Underground. So I don't think they were copying anyone. They were just kind of, it was that brilliant thing of like, if you're too self-conscious about what you're creating, it's not going to work. And I think the beauty of what they did and the influence they had is because maybe like punk in some ways, there was a naivety about it. They didn't quite know what they were doing. Just in the same way that the Sex Pistols didn't say, right, let's start a punk movement and do this thing. They just started a band and it plowed into something else.
And they didn't really have the kind of commercial success that you'd imagine that impact would bring with it, did they? You know, Rip It Up was the famous hit for Orange Juice. But kind of beyond that, they weren't kind of like chart bands in a way.
Well, they were always thinking they were. I mean, they literally thought, you know, we can go from the sock drawer to Top of the Pops. That was always like the ambition.
Is that a chapter name?
It should be. That's the musical.
On the paperback.
That's the West End musical.
It's a slightly dodgily named musical.
From the sock drawer, the musical. But I mean, that's the whole thing. Because I mean, Postcard is held up as kind of like the roots of indie music as we know it. And what indie became, I think, for me anyway, when the indie scene flourished, it became quite kind of like underachieving and kind of like separatist pop music. It didn't try. And I think what was great about, you know, Orange Juice, as naive as they were, they generally thought, right, these records that we're making for a couple of hundred quid are good enough to get in the top 40.
And I love the bit where you describe them coming to do Top of the Pops with Rip It Up. And by then, they'd kind of lost some of their band members along the way. And I think one of them, you said, they decided he probably wasn't right for the band because he had a habit of pulling out his guitar and strumming silently
that
to
was
himself.
That's the enigma. That is James Kirk, other than Edwin, was a great songwriter in Orange Juice. He sort of banned himself from interviews because every time they tried to do an interview, he'd say things like, I'm not into electronic music because I once got a shock from a plug and things like that. So he was just sort of, you know, I mean, all the people around Postcard were these very, very odd people. You know, they weren't like, you know, straight up. They were each one was sort of like eccentrics in their way. But yeah, talking about the not being commercially successful, I suppose it's that thing in a way of using the analogy of the Velvet Underground, which is a big influence. The Velvet Underground weren't a commercially successful band, but yet they, you know, this is the thing, I think, is it the Brian Eno quote saying that, you know, their first album only sold 2,000 copies, but everyone who bought that copy went on to form a band. I think Postcard had that same sort of effect in terms of, no, they weren't hugely commercially successful, but everybody who kind of bought and took interest or took notice of Postcard went on and to do something much bigger.
And I wanted to talk about the sort of accidental glamour of it. You mentioned Alan Horn was from East Coats.
Saltcoats, rather,
which sort of sounds like it could be in a Morrissey song, doesn't it? It sounds like winter seaside
it
or something.
Is, yeah, the Scottish Morrissey.
Yeah. And there's a bit of that sort of accidental glamour about it. They all were sort of hankering after Bolan and Ziggy Stardust and all the rest of it. Yeah. And this was their way of doing it. Did that sort of sit comfortably with this sort of DIY aesthetic, or did they, again, not think that it was really DIY? They just thought, this is how you set up a record label. We'll go and make sure we bump into John Peel in the streets. We'll kind of propagandize the music press.
Yeah, I think a lot of the punk generation, post-punk generation, they're all Bowie kids, all Bolan kids. I mean, pretty much anyone, because they were all born sort of like late 50s, came of age. If you took anybody of that era from, you know, whether it's Alan Horn and Edwin or whether it's Morrissey or Ian McCulloch or the whole Liverpool lot, I mean, Bowie was like the god to all of them, really. But in terms of the DIY thing, I just don't think that they knew. They did not know that that's what they shouldn't do. They didn't know how to. It was that brilliant thing of they didn't know about pluggers and you know, the normal ways to get on the radio. They just thought it was very much leading a horse to water and forcing it to drink and
clapping, you know, clapping its balls between two bricks.
Exactly. Well, yeah. In the case of John Peel, perhaps. But you know. But I think again, and also, I mean, also as well, it's that kind of that bravado of the insecure young man. I mean, you don't really. Like many of us might have been at some point in our lives, if you're a slightly insecure young man, you kind of mask that with what can be perceived as arrogance, and often it comes from a place of insecurity. So, you know, their famous doorstepping of John Peel when Alan Horn said to him, you know, wise up, old man, that was as much fear as anything else, or maybe bad speed, as Alan Horn says. So, who knows?
There is that.
Simon, tell me, the way that you've written the book isn't just like a kind of a straight music book.
But
it comes across as, you know, it's not fiction, but it comes across in a writerly prose, a way of writing that isn't, you know, your strict old music journalism. Why did you decide that that was the way to tell this tale?
I'm just after the film rights. Plain and simple. I just thought, because I thought...
From the suck drawer.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I just thought... I thought in a way I could see it as a film, like a film in my head, and I thought I wanted the reader to feel like they were kind of like watching something rather than learning something. And I thought I'd rather feel like they're watching like a fictionalized biography than a documentary. And I thought, in a way, I thought I wanted it to be, I mean, if you want to use the comparison with the Factory Records story, obviously there was some very straightforward books written about Factory and documentaries. And then there's also Michael Winterbottom's pantomime of the 24-hour party people. And I thought, well, I'm just going to cut out the middleman and I'm just going to write the 24-hour party people pantomime version of Postcard. And if people don't like it, well, then they can go and do their back issues of Record Collector and talk about catalogue numbers and B-sides. But I'd rather give them like the romance and the fantasy and kind of like, rather than kind of debunk the myth, I thought I'd just put the bellows to the myth and make it even more outrageous.
Well, it is a preposterous story beautifully told by Simon Goddard. The book is called Simply Thrill, The Preposterous Story of Postcard Records, and it's out now. Simon, thank you very much.
Thank you. Cheers.
It's a green thumbs up from us for Tokyo's leading flower market and auction, where merchants indulge in the business of buying blooms.
The Japanese flower market is the place for perfectionists. Anyone looking for a branch of cherry blossom just before it flowers, or a blemish-free orchid with every flower facing the same way.
Blooms or Bust, a photographic essay on the Ota flower market, now showing in the film section on monocle.com.
You're tuned in to The Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck. Don't get fooled by the title. Let's Talk About Love, Why Other People Have Such Bad Taste. It's not only a book about how cringeworthy Celine Dion's music is.
Let's talk about love.
What Canadian music critic Carl Wilson set out to do with Let's Talk About Love is a taste biography, where Celine Dion, a best-selling yet internationally loathed artist, serves as a reference to explore why we like what we like and hate what we hate.
The book was originally published in 2007 and met with such praise that a new edition is out now with additional essays on taste by other musicians, writers and thinkers. Carl Wilson joins us now from our Toronto bureau. Carl, first of all, explain to us why you put Celine Dion at the heart of this first book about taste. And I'm sure it's not just that you're all sitting up there in Canada.
It's not, but that's relevant to the reason I made that decision. The idea of writing about where taste came from was an idea that I'd had for a long time, but it always felt a little bit abstract as a subject to treat. And then in discussion with the editors of the 33 and a Third series, which is where this book first appeared, I was batting around ideas. The format of the series is that it's a bunch of small books, each one about a single album. And I discussed possibly doing something about a Randy Newman album and then a Peru Ubu album. And they were a little hesitant to do things that they found too nichey. And so I was in a slight state of irritation about that, went to the Recording Industry Association of America's website and was looking at the list of the best-selling albums of all time at the time, just in some ways to work out my irritation at the time, and was surprised to find that there were, at the time, you know, in the mid-2000s, there were three Celine Dion albums on the top 20 list of the time. And that I hadn't quite realized that her sales were of that scale. And I also sort of had an immediate moment of intuition where I felt like, you know, there is something I could write about Celine Dion. And this idea of writing about taste came back to me. And it was the feeling that I think as a Canadian that, you know, out of all of the sort of mainstream pop music that I maybe had some disdain for at the time, there was a more personal relationship to what Celine seemed to represent, the way that she represented Canadian music to the world, and that I perhaps felt more embarrassed or shamed in some ways by Celine than I did by other sort of generic pop artists. And so that was kind of a little edge of personal animosity and also troubledness. Also the sense that if I was having this relationship to the celebrity where I felt ashamed by what she meant in the world, that maybe there was something not quite right there. Maybe there was something that needed to be worked out. And it started me off thinking about what that implied about what I thought about her audience and the people who listened to her, and whether I was putting myself in an antagonistic relationship to these millions of strangers around the world, that perhaps I hadn't accounted for the real meaning of that.
And I wanted to ask you about the idea that the relationship between an artist and their audience is a sort of bond of trust, isn't it, Carl? Is the reason that Celine Dion, to use a Britishism, is so naff is because people don't trust her. People, maybe she's emoting falsely when she's on stage. She's too over the top. She's got too many sequins on her dress to be able to really tell us any home truths about the human condition as an artist. Do you know what I mean?
Right, and that's the kind of knee-jerk response that we have, right? We read the signals and signs that an artist is giving us kind of through the social filters that we go through the world with. And so when we see something that we would find tacky in our everyday lives in a show business context, we kind of translate that to meaning the same thing. But of course, pop culture is a performative thing. It's mm-hmm. constructed out of all kinds of signs and signals, and it doesn't actually signify the same things. And the other thing is, you know, if you found somebody overdressed or garish or perhaps a little bit too overtly emotional in a social context, that has all kinds of implications. You know, that's often a kind of class prejudice. And so our distrust of the genuineness of a performer's emotions on that level, and also our assumption that they're not actually the creators of their own work and that somebody's manipulating them and that this is all sort of exploitative and driven purely by capital. These are all, you know, assumptions that we take when we have a different class position than that. And, you know, so one of the things that I did for the book was want to talk to people who did not find her tacky or naff and to find out why they felt sincerely that she was representative of things in their own emotional lives. And, you know, and in talking to fans, I found kind of fascinating stories of those kinds of attachments that people had.
And there's a problem or discussion around popularity here, isn't there, Carl? Because it seems like actually, in fact, the more popular you are as an artist, as a singer, you're almost more worthy of criticism. You might say more to us about being human than any amount of Randy Newmans and Pierre Ubus, potentially, because it tells us about us. We can see ourselves or a version of ourselves in the people that cry and emote terribly at her concerts, right?
Yeah, and you know, there's that kind of 50 million Elvis fans can't be wrong, right? Yeah. that title. And yet, in some ways, in critical culture, the opposite prejudice had started to develop, where it's like, if somebody has 50 million fans, they must be wrong. So
yeah, familiarity breeds contempt, doesn't it, as well?
Yeah, you know? Exactly. And to think, you know, that somehow anything that's reaching the masses is somehow been a bit of a product of a conspiracy. And so I started to think, and I think that this is, you know, a tradition that comes in many ways out of cultural studies developed out of the UK, to think that anything that has that kind of mass appeal, first of all, has to have something going on, right? Because not just anything achieves that. And also that immediately that creates millions of narratives of the ways that people are listening to this and making meaning out of it in their own lives. And so that those things are definitely worth investigating.
Now, I know that something you've touched on already in pieces that you've written is that actually 10, 15, 20 years ago, to be cool in the world of music, you probably had to be hanging out in the right bars and knowing the clubs to go to, and then you would hear or see something that was memorable and special, and you'd be part of an elite because you were part of a kind of underground movement. Now you click on YouTube and you can see that same event 2 minutes later, and you can jump to another event in another city around the world. Coolness is available to everybody who knows where to look, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, and the knowing where to look is still a matter of, you know, you have to have some kind of cultural in to know that. But it's certainly not the kind of painstaking investigation that when I was a teenager, it felt like, you know, you would have cottoned on to a particular album and then you would start trying to find records that had any of those same people playing on it, and you would see a stray reference to a club, and then you would hope that someday when you got to that city you could go to that club and gradually put together this mystery of where all of these things came from. And now that whole process is certainly telescoped.
How do you get rescued from naffness, Carl? Because I wonder where on the sort of matrix where Celine is compared to, say, Dolly Parton or Cher or similar people that have clearly been sort of rescued from naffness, haven't they? We've seen the beating heart beneath their sequin dresses, haven't we, all these ladies? Where do you think she sits in that matrix, and how do you maybe get rescued, rehabilitated from naffness?
Well, one of these things is longevity, right? So, you know, did you talk about Dolly Parton or Cher, who I think still kind of fights the fight a little bit. But
I think you're right.
but they're sort of a generation older than Celine is, and so they've had a couple of more decades, and these stakes start to change over time. You know, when people are still part of the current pop conversation and sort of youth-oriented pop conversation, coolness matters a lot more. But gradually, they seem to start to represent other values, right? They seem to start to represent stories over the decades. And so Dolly Parton comes to represent a certain thing about, you know, both the rural South and feminism and the way popular culture, showbiz culture, was working in a particular time. And we now can kind of look at her as a kind of pioneer of an independent woman's voice. She was kind of the country Madonna in a lot of ways. And so, like, those stories start to come clear with sort of historical perspective. And also, their audiences become more prominent, you know, and I think a lot of these female divas, the gay audience actually ends up being the people who redeem them, you know, that they kind of can read through the multiple meanings and the sort of camp levels of figures like that. And after a few decades, that view of them spreads, leaches out into the general population, and we all kind of take on that kind of ironic affection for these figures and come to an appreciation.
Carl, I wanted to add on to that because, you know, we've just had a whole week of Eurovision, and I presume all of those songs are kind of naff. It's a naff world. It's a celebration of naffness. But is there a kind of weird kind of, you know, class thing that plays out here? Because actually there's kind of like lots of middle class people who have parties. They laugh at it. They find it entertaining. They probably will even download the song that wins. But there's a kind of an odd kind of, there's a bit of a sneer at, you know, what's going on for the masses.
Yeah, there's this kind of holding yourself at a distance as though you might be infected by this cultural contagion, right? And that somehow it will transform you into the person that you fear falling into becoming. So there's you know, the irony is a defense mechanism against that. And a lot of taste operates on this kind of, you know, the things that we look down on. I think there's a defensiveness about making sure that it's known that we're not that kind of person.
But I was going to say, I do worry that sometimes with that irony that actually people actually secretly like it.
Yeah.
Well, that's, yeah, I don't worry about that. I actually think that that's at least the, you know, irony can be kind of the thin edge of the wedge that, like, eventually leads you around to realize
it's a slippery
slope. You do actually like this on something. You know, and that its virtues aren't something that you need to feel threatened by. The fact that it's catchy or over the top or emotional is maybe there's something there that in a lot of your cultural life you're not getting.
Well, Carl, that was lovely speaking to you. Thank you very much indeed for that. That was music critic and author Carl Wilson. The new edition of Let's Talk About Love, Why Other People Have Such Bad Taste, is out now, and it includes essays also by Nick Hornby, Daphne Brooks, James Franco and Marco Roth. And there we have it. That's edition 253 of the Monocle Weekly.
And a very nice one it was too.
That was nice to be back in the saddle with you, Andrew, again.
Good.
Thank you for having me.
Pleasure.
Well, there's only one saddle. I'm bareback. Oh, yeah.
We could recommend a game to people at home. We can't do it on air.
But the BAP drinking game.
Type your name into the anagram machine. Okay. I literally can't say any of yours on air, but the anagram machine was very good and very relevant with some very funny words for Mr. Robert Bound. Try it at home, kids. It's entertaining.
That was one of the things that that kept us through the long hours here at Monocle Towers this week, wasn't it?
It actually made me cry.
There was a lot of hooting with laughter, a lot of tears.
Anagrams are good.
And I've got about 3,000 anagrams of the word or the name Robert Bound.
I know.
Quite a lot of them are pretty
rude,
strong. They're blue. Aren't they?
Yes. But
what was yours, Andrew? What was yours?
Well, that's how it innocently started. Someone said, have you ever used an anagram of your name? And I said,
I've used a pseudonym.
Yes, yeah. Ken Warduct.
Ken Warduct, yeah.
Which was all modest. And then we tried to find super ones for other people, and they came up with rude ones. Anyway, that's another. We'll return to that maybe. We'll find some less rude ones for next week.
Less rude ones?
Yeah,
I think it only really works if they're rude.
Okay. All right, well, we'll think about it.
But we'll maybe give us a clue or something.
Give us a clue.
Give us a clue.
Okay.
Should we thank everyone?
Yes, let's
thank
everyone.
Should we thank our guests? Weren't they all wonderful?
They were marvellous.
Music writers of two stripes.
Sam Goda, very nice.
Yeah, very nice indeed. Carl Wilson, also very amusing on his book about bad taste.
Yes, I feel a bit worried about my own taste, but anyway, there you go.
And Carlotta Gall as well. That's one of those jobs that's probably very exciting, but yeah, it's kind of worth writing a book about it. You kind of want to get everything, all your thoughts in order, presumably, when you spent over 10 years in Afghanistan.
Yeah, and just amazing when you see world events that are always described in one way, and you just take a slightly different perspective and you see a completely different tale.
We're going to thank our crew behind the glass. Today's show was produced by Daphne Denis, and our studio manager was Claire Urban. We'll be here again at the same time next week. But for now, from me, Robert Bounds.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.